We have just completed a 9-week journey through God's story. The one true story of all stories. The story of God's creation, His perfect and harmonious creation. The fall of mankind, our personal need for a Savior, and God's promise of such a Savior. The life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ that secured for His people an eternity in a fully restored new heavens and new earth where we will be forever with God. During this time, we thought about what it means to live as a participant, a character, if you will, in God's story. And most importantly, we considered our unique God-given opportunity to speak the truth of this story into the lives of all of those whom God has sovereignly brought into our lives. We looked at the many ways that He has superintended our lives, our individual lives and circumstances, to providentially equip us to be His ambassadors to a people that we alone may be able to reach. All that leads us to this morning, to the beginning of our spring sermon series through the book of Esther. The book of Esther was not chosen randomly or just because we need to go back to the Old Testament for a little bit in order to fulfill some kind of checklist some of you may be following. No, Esther was chosen specifically because the message of Esther, the story of Esther, dovetails so well with the responsibilities we have to share God's story in the midst of cultural exile. We are in a culture now with no earthly king, no earthly temple, no earthly prophet. Instead, we find ourselves living in a culture that has denied or ignored the very existence of the God that we love and serve. A culture where He is virtually absent. And this is the world in which Esther lived. Indeed, the book of Esther never even mentions the name of God. He's not in there. Well, He's not visibly in there. Other than the fact that the story is about the Jewish people, there's nothing even inherently Jewish about it in the religious sense. It really is a non-religious book. There's no temple. There are no specific prayers. There are no references to God or His working in people's lives. There's not even a miracle that you can see in the book of Esther. There are a lot of really good resources for a study of Esther. If you'd like to pick some up, I can make some recommendations. I have several commentaries that I've been consulting for this study. One of the ones that's top of my list is the NIV Application Commentary on the Book of Esther, written by Karen Jobes. She does a tremendous job of helping us to see the connection between Esther and the story of Esther and today. In fact, much of I relied heavily on her and her insights in the crafting of today's introduction. But in order for us to completely understand Esther, it's important that we understand the story as a whole first. And I won't make the assumption that you've all read through Esther multiple times or that you're familiar with the story, although I hope that you are. And I also probably should mention that there are some spoiler alerts in this introduction. But the reason why I think it's important to get an overview of Esther as part of an introduction to Esther is because this book really makes the most sense practically and theologically when it's considered as a whole. And so even as we begin to work our way through the book of Esther verse by verse and chapter by chapter over the next several weeks, I'm often going to jump around from the section we're in and to some resolution. Some of what I explained this morning will make the reasons for that sort of thing more clear. Esther has all of the elements of a great story. I'm sure that somebody has done a movie adaptation of Esther, although I've not watched any. But if they haven't, it really would make a good story. Hollywood could make it and not even be accused of keeping God out of the story because he's not even in it, in the book. But what are some of the elements of the story of Esther? Well, you have a king. There's a king in the book of Esther. I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a few moments. There's a king who, at a party one time, drank too much. And he had a queen, a beautiful queen. And he was looking to parade her in front of his drunken party guests, and she refused. This was a king who, like most kings, was not very interested in being refused anything. And so he passed a law that effectively banished her from being queen and kind of kicked her out of her royal position. There was some fear among the men of that culture that if the queen was seen acting like that, then all the rest of the men would have significant problems at home with their own wives following that lady's rebellious example. And that's why they needed a law against this beautiful queen. And so we find this king, after having kicked his wife out, feeling a bit lonely. And so, as kings often do, he held a nationwide, or in this case, empire-wide beauty pageant in order to find the most beautiful girl in his empire in order to replace that rebellious wife he had. So there's this, and in this story, the unlikely young woman who is chosen harkens back to stories of whether it's Cinderella or other fairy tales of the unlikely young girl being chosen. You've got that too. And then, of course, that even in the midst of this story, there's a good side story going on. There's these two men, one of whom is in a pretty important position, and a position that requires people to bow down to him and acknowledge his personal greatness. But another guy, who happens to be related to the woman who gets to be queen, Esther in this case, he has a millennia-old grudge between his people and this leader's people, and so he refuses to bow down, and there's this huge plot that involves the bad guy thinking, how can I not only destroy this guy, but everybody related and connected to him? So there's a plan for genocide in this book. But like all good stories, there are plot twists and other characters that come in and situations. It's a very exciting story. It's a very exciting story. I would encourage you to read it. But let's look at some of the history behind this story. Because like all other stories in the Bible, this is not a fictional story. This is a true story. This is a story that actually took place in time and history. For you history buffs, we'll have a little bit more to say about when and who some of these characters were. But let me start by saying that all of the events recorded in the book of Esther take place in biblical history after the decree of Cyrus in 539 BC. So this is 400 or 500 years before the time of Christ that this is taking place. You'll remember from your Old Testament history class or studying 30 Days to Understanding the Bible that because of their rebellion, God exiled his people. He allowed another country to take them over. And when Babylon, the nation of Babylon, actually conquered Judah and it burnt the temple to the ground, King Nebuchadnezzar, instead of killing everybody, took most of the Jewish people into exile. He took them back to his country where they served him. And there's a whole lot we can say about that history. Suffice it to say that one nation was conquered by another nation, and that leader's nation, his name was Cyrus, and he was head of the Medo-Persian Empire. They destroyed Babylon. They beat Babylon. The Bible tells us that's also a very interesting story, how Babylon the Great fell. I didn't want to get into too much history, but this is an interesting story. Daniel chapter 5 tells this one. Belshazzar, who was the king of that time of Babylon, was kind of a waste. He was a drunk. And at one of his drunken parties, you'll remember the story of Daniel with the handwriting on the wall, and they called Daniel in and said, hey, you've been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Sorry, buddy, time's up. While that party was going on, Daniel 5 tells us about that. History also records that at that moment, Cyrus and a bunch of Medo-Persians were crawling through the sewers and the canals of Babylon, and they took the nation of Babylon without killing anybody. They just showed up, were there, and so the Medo-Persians took over Babylon. This was a huge empire. This was a huge empire that spanned from one section of the known world to another, and when Cyrus became king, one of the first things he did was to issue a decree that would allow many of the people that Babylon had captured, it would allow them to return to their homelands. Okay? The decree of Cyrus. The Bible talks about this as well as history does. We've actually found historical evidence on a clay tablets that record the works of Cyrus, where he actually did what the Bible said he did. And it wasn't just the Jews, but many captured people were allowed the freedom to go back to their countries and reestablish them. Now, Cyrus is an interesting guy. He is the only pagan leader who's ever referenced in the Bible by God actually calls Cyrus his anointed. Cyrus was a shepherd in the Bible to the people of Israel because God used this pagan king to send his people back to the Holy Land following the time that he had allotted for them to be in exile as punishment for their sins. So Cyrus has sent the Jewish people and many other people back to their nations, and he's begun to finance the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem and even the rebuilding of the temple. You can read about that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah to see how that happens in biblical history as well. But what's interesting is that Esther takes place kind of in the middle of all of this. Cyrus is gone. Other kings have come into place behind him. And she is now, she is a Jewish person who didn't leave when they were allowed to leave. You see, when Cyrus gave his decree and said, feel free to go back to your homeland, all of you Jewish people, feel free to go back and we'll get you set up and we'll get your countries back in order. Now, let me put one more aside in here. In case you think Cyrus was a really good guy, he wasn't. This was a political move, totally, because these places were pretty much just empty spaces. So by sending people back into the far corners of the empire, he has now put governments back in place that he can do what to? Tax. This was a way to make money. This was a way to keep his borders safe, because he would have outlying provinces that he controlled. And by letting people go back and giving them a bit of freedom, they were happy to do that. They got to go back to the land of their fathers, but he also had a little bit more control over his kingdom. Sorry, I didn't mean to besmirch Cyrus too badly, but don't give him too much credit. Now, but some Jewish people made the decision not to return to their homeland. It shouldn't be very surprising to us that they didn't, or even why they didn't. They had been living in exile for 50 years when Cyrus gave his decree. All right? So most of them who had come from the land of Israel had already died. And others had been born and raised. You know, 50 years, you can have two or three generations being born in that span of time. And these were people who, though, although Jewish, had grown up in these other places. And many of them had, probably all of them had, businesses and livelihoods and homes and lands and things like that. And they just didn't want to go. Many of us, some of you and some of us in our lifetime have seen a similar thing. And after World War II, when Israel was once again given the right to be their own nation and the land of Israel was given back to them by a cooperative effort of the United Nations, there was a mass movement of Jewish people from all corners of the world who went back to Israel to settle in the Holy Land. But many, many, many did not. They just didn't. They'll go back and visit, but they had established lives other places, and they didn't stop being Jewish per se, but they didn't return to the homeland. Esther and Mordecai, two of our main characters in the book of Esther, were Jewish people who decided to stay, to not go back to the land of their fathers. So by the time, and what's interesting to me too about Esther and Mordecai, you know, I've read a lot of things, and as a kid, a lot of times, when we grow up reading the Bible, we try to look for the good in Bible characters, things that we can emulate, examples to follow, whatever. And it's interesting, we see Esther as a the hero of the story, and in one sense she is. And we see Mordecai. I always pictured Mordecai as this older, wise, bearded man who sat around dispensing bits of wisdom to Esther from time to time. But you know, when I started reading the book of Esther as an adult, as a pastor, Esther and Mordecai frustrate me. They frustrate me. They're not the typical Bible characters that I'm expecting to see. You know, when the children of Israel went into exile, the first of the exiles we read about are Daniel. Remember him? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who they're in the court of this pagan king who says, hey, you've got to eat this barbecue. You've got to eat this bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. And they say, sorry, can't do it. Our God does not allow us to eat those things. We can't eat your food. As much as it may look good to us, we cannot eat it. They resisted the paganization of themselves. They resisted accommodating their culture. And they paid a high price for that from time to time. Daniel did rise in power, but he had some trouble along the way. Do you remember the lion's den? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to an idol. And what happened to them? They were thrown into a fiery furnace. Now, God rescued them from that, but they said, we don't even care if our God doesn't rescue us. We're not bowing down to you. Those are heroes. Those are the people I like. Esther and Mordecai. Mordecai tells Esther, hey, don't let anybody know you're Jewish. You know, you got to hide that. I can imagine Daniel saying, whoa. As another exile, I need to tell you, we don't hide the fact that we are God-fearing, God-following people. We stand up for that. And when I look for examples in the Bible of being strong in your faith, honestly, if you read Esther and Mordecai carefully in that book, they're not that. They are not standing up for their faith per se. In fact, I'll tell you more about this as we get into the chapter where it comes out. Mordecai and Haman, even their battle isn't strictly faith-based. They both have, Mordecai is Jewish. Haman comes from, he's a descendant of the Amalekites, the first people to attack the Israelites on their way to the Holy Land. So Haman is basically a descendant of Esau, who his great-great-great-great-grandparents attacked Mordecai's great-great-great-great-great-grandparents when they were trying to cross into the Promised Land. And so really what you've got here is more of a tribal grudge between Mordecai's pride is what prevents him from bowing down to Haman, not his love for God. At least that doesn't come up in the text. Which brings me to an important point about when we read Esther. You cannot read the book of Esther like you're reading a newspaper account of the story. Not even like we read history books. You see, our problem is we're looking at this book a few thousand years removed from the culture in which it was shared. Today, our history books are generally boring, right? They're just kind of straightforward accounts of what happened, which is why so many people love the genre of historical fiction, because they like a story that brings in those historical elements. The problem with historical fiction is that it's fiction, and you never really know for sure. So we like our history books in the modern era, we like our history books dry and dusty and boring and filled with dates and maps and things like that. In the ancient Near East, they told their history in a much more enjoyable way. They recounted it in the narrative form, which is another reason why I chose Esther as our next stop in sermons, because Esther, it'll help us to see how she was part of a story and how God was revealed through her story, even though he doesn't even get mentioned in the book. So anyway, Esther is a story told. It's history told in narrative. It's about real people. It's about a real thing that happened. This isn't a metaphor. This isn't a story made up to try to make a spiritual point about things. This is a real story. There really were these characters. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of these characters. So the Babylonian, the Persian Empire at this point was massive, okay? It was just a massive kingdom. The story in this book, in Esther, takes place in Susa, which was the capital, one of, I think, two or three. Persia had two or three capitals in their empire. And this book is set in Susa. That city, we still know where that city is. We've done archaeological excavations of it. It's located in modern-day Iran, okay? The Bible refers to, the book of Esther refers to the king, the Persian king, by the name Ahasuerus, okay? Ahasuerus. Now, which brings up another interesting point. If you are called upon to read the scriptures during our study of the book of Esther, you feel free to pronounce these names any way you want. There are those out there that will tell you, in fact, a couple of my commentaries have phonetic spelling. That's how I know to say Ahasuerus. But it's a very awkward thing to say. So if you don't want to say Ahasuerus when you're reading, you just want to say Ahasuerus or whatever, a Hershey's bar. I don't care what you call him. We all understand that we don't speak that language. These pronunciations are lost to us in spite of what the experts say. We'll agree that it's Esther, Mordecai, Haman, and the king. King A. Or call him by his Greek name if you like. His name was Xerxes. Now some of you history buffs, especially military history buffs, know a lot about Xerxes. In fact, Xerxes, we have an excellent account from the Greek historian Herodotus, who wrote extensively about the Persians. And Xerxes was a serious, serious king. Xerxes, Ahasuerus, I'm talking about the same guy now, and it's important. I'm not wasting time on history here because you need to know a lot about this guy to understand what's at place. Sometimes in our reading of stories, when we don't know the characters or we can't place them contextually, we can read a story and think of this guy as kind of a silly drunken king, right? He wasn't. He was a vile, wicked, he had a terrible temper. I'll tell you a little bit more about him later. This was the Xerxes who took the Persians and faced King Leonidas of the Spartans. Remember the story of the 300 who resisted? This is the Persian king. This is the Persian king that fought those guys. This guy, like his father before him, tried to conquer Greece and never did. Never managed to conquer Greece in all of his time. But he got pretty close a number of times, and that was one where he got pretty close. Herodotus characterizes him as the tallest and most handsome of all the Persian kings. That matters to you. He was, however, ambitious and ruthless, a brilliant warrior, and a jealous lover. Now, I believe, as I've stated already, that the book of Esther is, in fact, a historical account of the events that happened in that time. Now, I recognize that as a narrative form, there may be some literary or poetic licenses that are taken from time to time. I'll tell you about one of those in a second. But I do believe it's history. The Bible teaches that it's history, too, because its opening line is exactly the same as all the other history books of the Bible. It opens with the same opening line, opening statement as those. Here's the one place that people will give us the most grief on Esther, and it does come down to the names. It does come down to the names. Esther has been questioned historically because the names of the characters seem inconsistent with the names that would be expected when you read other historians like Herodotus and stuff. But here's a way I think that, here's what I think is happening there, a pretty simple answer. First of all, Xerxes is a Ahasuerus, is actually his Hebrew version of the name Xerxes. But because Esther is history told in the narrative form, it's interesting to point out that the reason probably the Hebrew name is used is because when you read King Ahasuerus and you pronounce it in Hebrew, it sounds like you're saying King Headache. That's what that Ahasuerus sounds like, the Hebrew word for headache. And Vashti, the queen who, the Persian queen who is deposed, okay, her name actually means, in old Persian, it means beautiful woman or beloved. And so it's possible that the storyteller was just referring to her as the beautiful queen, okay, and not giving necessarily her true technical name. Esther means, it sounds similar to the Babylonian goddess named Ishtar in Hebrew, and she was the god of love and war, two themes that we see in Esther. And Mordecai sounds like a god of war, Marmaduke. And then even Haman, the villain, his name in Hebrew means wrath or anger. So is there a good chance that these were real people and the storytellers just gave them names that made the story better without changing any of the historicity of the story? Again, if you were reading a newspaper or a modern history account, that should bother you. We don't take those kinds of liberties or licenses when we write things today, but that was a perfectly acceptable and understandable thing. All right, now let's talk a little bit about the theology and the practical side of Esther for us. Okay. So what's the point? It's a nice story, but God isn't even mentioned. How is this important to me today? How can I apply the book of Esther to my life today? Well, one of the amazing things about Esther, the theology of Esther, and I know that it sounds somewhat ironic to refer to the theology of a book that doesn't mention God even once. In fact, it seems that the author goes out of his way to deliberately avoid mentioning God or anything associated with religion at all. But I think it's intentional, and here's why. Christian theology is also concerned with the character of what theologians refer to as the unseen God. You know, when you read the scriptures and you read these amazing accounts of all that God has done for his people over the ages, one of the things I get a lot of time is, why isn't God doing that kind of stuff now for us like he did for all those other people? But you have to recognize that you're seeing snapshots when you read the Bible. It wasn't like that from creation until the resurrection, and then it started dwindling off after the time of the apostles. Most periods of human history, God is relatively silent, not present in a way that we think about when we read Bible stories. The Esther story is actually an example at how one crucial moment in history, all the promises that God made to his people are fulfilled. And they're not fulfilled by some miraculous intervention on God's point, on God's part, where he sends a lightning bolt down to fry the enemies of the Jews, or he goes before them and parts the Red Sea to rescue them from all of the plans that their enemies have. No, he does it through ordinary, regular type people doing ordinary, regular type people stuff. And that sounds a lot like the world that we live in today. So once the theological message of the book is understood, then we can start to mine it for how it can help us, those of us who today really are also exiles. We're not in the promised land yet. We haven't gone to the place where we are truly citizens. We are living today in a culture that has effectively silenced God, that has kept him out of the important parts of life. When you turn on the news in the evening, there's a world events, current events, weather. They even talk about sports news. There's no God news. And here's what God was up to today in America. It's not there. The Esther story shows us as God's people what it's like to watch God work behind the scenes. To watch how even when one of the greatest things about Esther are these reversals. These reversals that happen. You're going to see several of them. One of them, the biggest one, you know, the villain gets the king to sign a decree to kill all of the Jewish people in the province, in the empire of Persia, and in some just normal, everyday course of event stuff, that thing gets turned, and this guy ends up getting hung on the very gallows that he had built to hang the other guy. And God doesn't stop in and do that. He doesn't confuse anybody's brain. He doesn't switch around anything. He just lets the events go as the individuals with their freedom are letting happen. It's an amazing, amazing thing. Without the invention of the miraculous, it's what we call, and here's the word of the day. You can write it down. It's going to come up a lot. The word of the day is providence. We say that a lot. Oh, and God's providence or God's providential care. But have you really thought about what providence is? When we speak of God's providence, we mean that God in some invisible and inscrutable way that we can't understand governs all creatures, actions, and circumstances through the ordinary, normal course of human life without the intervention of the miraculous. You want me to say that again? When we speak of God's providence, we mean that God in some invisible and inscrutable way governs all creatures, actions, and circumstances through the normal and the ordinary course of everyday human life without the intervention of the miraculous. That's what we believe happens. And Esther shows us how that happens, and nobody's free will is getting violated. Nobody's being turned into a robot. None of the things that make so many people freak out about God's providential care and God's orchestrating all events. This is the theme of our story. That no matter where I'm at today, no matter what's going through, it doesn't matter if it's my fault. God is still working to accomplish his purposes in spite of my failure. In spite of my failure. Isn't that what we preach from Romans? We believe that God works all things. He works all things out for his glory and for the good of those who love him. All things, guys, doesn't mean just the good stuff, the happy stuff, the fun stuff. It means all stuff. All things. And that's why Mordecai could say, and this is probably the one place Mordecai got some theology right. He said, and this is where you can see him deliberately shying away from mentioning the name of God in the story. Mordecai says to Esther, hey, you might be afraid to go in and talk to this king. And if you do, you need to know something. First of all, God's people, I can't even help myself not to say it. He said, deliverance will come for the Jews. It'll come for the Jews. And so he's saying, stating there exactly what we're saying. God promised to deliver his people. Mordecai says to Esther, God's going to deliver his people without even mentioning his name. He tells her that's going to happen. The Jews will be rescued. But you may be just the person that he's planning on using. Maybe you're in that place you're in right now for just that kind of purpose and just this kind of time. Do you believe that about your circumstances? That's the question to ask. So the next time you're there and somebody on the bus starts crying next to you and looks at you and said, is there a God? Can you help me? I need to know if there's a God. Don't bother looking around for somebody else. You answer that question. You talk to them. And if you look at the people that run around in your house, your children, your spouse, don't ask, who is going to lead them to Christ? We need a better program at the church. No, you don't. You need to be faithful where God has put you and over whom God has placed you in responsibility. For such a time as this is the theme of our preaching through Esther. Because just like Esther, every one of us is in a position today where God is planning on using you. You just have to open up your eyes and realize you're the one to be used. You're the one to be used. Oh, there's so many more things we could say, but we won't. We'll get to them as we open the book. They'll all come back up again. So providence. God is working things out according to his plan through the everyday, ordinary, regular stuff that you and I are doing. Let's be happy about that and encouraged by that. Let's pray. Father, help us as we begin this journey through the book of Esther. Open our eyes, open our ears to hear the things from it that you would like us to learn. Above all, Father, help us to see your providential care in all things as you work all things out according to your purpose and will for your glory. Amen.